kids, Matt Segundo here, and this is the first of four subsequent shows devoted in part or in whole to authors named Kate. Alas, very few of them actually kissed me, but then again, I wasn't there. It was our young roving correspondent who interviewed these lovely ladies, and that damn fool, so full of journalistic integrity, who didn't even attempt to cop a feel. Anyway, our first guest for this program is Catherine Taylor, who is apparently fond of setting down rules while the rest of us are all too eager to break them.
Okay, so I am here without a voice, but with Catherine Taylor, author of Rules for Saying Goodbye. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. First off, I wanted to actually ask you about this kind of phenomenon that we're sort of seeing. I talked with Marion Wiggins on Monday, and I'm talking with you now, and both of you wrote books with your name as a sort of alter ego. How did this come about?
During the course of writing the book, my protagonist had a lot of different names, and toward the end, I realized that I thought the name Catherine Taylor was the best.
Ah.
Also, when you write a sort of semi-autobiographical novel or a novel that has any autobiographical elements whatsoever, and it's your first, people are going to assume that the main character is you.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so calling her Catherine Taylor was my own private joke to myself.
Did this start off as a sort of, I guess, a work of fiction or a memoir? I mean, we have a sort of kind of, you know, in the post-James Frey atmosphere, things about, you know, the memoir is kind of a sort of place where you can't really sort of take creative liberties with a subjective view. Was this kind of a sort of...
It was never a memoir. I never had any interest in writing a memoir. I wish I had had interest in writing a memoir because, I don't know, it might make a lot more money. But, no, it was always fiction.
Mm. Well, I mean, what is the difference, the disparity between you, Catherine Taylor, the person, and Catherine Taylor, the alter ego in this particular thing?
Well, she's definitely a fictional character. She makes different choices than I would make. The structure of the novel and much of what happens also happened to me, but the accounts are completely fictionalized, and she's, you know, she's a completely different person. She's sort of, I've been saying sometimes, the ugliest version of me.
Yeah.
She's, you know, not the most likable protagonist in the whole wide world, and I have tenderness for her because she's got a lot of flaws.
Mm-hmm. I want to actually ask you about sort of the declarative dialogue in this particular book. A lot of the characters pretty much are making sort of assertions about things like, you know, I want to do this or I want to do that, and it's all in the present tense. And I'm wondering how this actually sort of came about. Was this, you worked in bars, correct?
I did.
Yes, because you're getting a lot of press, unfortunately, for the whole David Byrne nonsense.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. But I wanted to actually ask you how this dialogue came about. I mean, you, of course, got an MFA. We were talking about that before this.
Yes.
But also, I mean, was this observational? Was this honed? Was this styled?
I'm not sure which dialogue you're talking about.
Well, let me give you an example. It's sort of like you have Clarissa state, I am a bad friend. I have crashed your dinner party and done nothing to help. Are we out of wine? Now, there's something that's sort of very... sort of like Joseph Mankiewicz about that, but there's also something very declarative and present tense about that. And it's all throughout the book. There is, it's kind of actually works in tandem with this whole rules theme, which we can talk about later. But I wanted to first of all talk about the dialogue here as to how this came about. Was it just a sort of a matter of being a stenographer, or was it a matter of, stylizing in some manner? Or?
Do people not speak like that? I thought that people just spoke like that.
Well, sometimes when people, you have a very sort of specific kind of beats in the dialogue, and I was wondering maybe you can describe, as I sort of say, I have a bad friend, why do this, I do that.
I think it's my voice, it's how I hear dialogue and the narrative, personally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's anything I consciously decided the book would be, you know, a series of declarative passages of dialogue. I guess I do write things down and then shoehorn them into the book later. I don't know. This is an interesting question about how a writer hears dialogue. And well, when I hear, not just dialogue, when I replay conversations I've had with people, I think, you know, I'm sure I don't replay them exactly as they happened, and I probably hear them in a much more declarative way.
Yeah. I mean, did you keep sort of notebooks during your time? Did this kind of help?
I always keep notebooks.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious as to, you know, how you developed this ear for dialogue. That's kind of what my sort of...
I'm not sure. I don't know. I think that when I wrote stories when I was, you know, in high school, they probably still had this sort of... The dialogue is, it not only is it, in, you know, in these declarative sentences, like you say, which it is. I'm so interested that you pointed this out to me because it's something I wouldn't have even noticed. You know, it's the way you hear, I don't know, it's the way I hear myself speak.
Or it's the way that the people that you, I guess, have been around sort of speak.
Maybe.
Or perhaps I'm just talking about something that was just probably perhaps in your subconscious in terms of like being able to sort of, I guess, carry forth a narrative like this that is built upon anecdotes and then having this kind of a thematic, larger sort of, you know, rules thing that kind of actually helps to guide her and helps to provide the readers with clues as to like, well, you know, she's floating through her life, not able to actually sort of really pinpoint what she wants to do.
This is only, I mean, that's the most subtle thing you think about when you're writing. It's certainly there. It's there on some barely conscious level, but it's not something that is right in the forefront of your brain when you're writing about people.
So for this, it was just a matter of just laying down the observational sort of things that were percolating in your brain.
And because I'm so interested in rules and obligation and things like this, it was going to be in the narrative anyway.
Yeah.
It was going to show up because that's what I'm interested in. Speaking of rules, yeah. I think what an MFA is good for is learning the rules.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not sure what else you learn. You know, you don't learn your style. You don't get your voice when you're going to school to get an MFA. You meet a lot of friends who will influence your writing. But a writer, I don't think, becomes a writer because they get an MFA or don't. Or it was helpful to me because I needed to learn some rules. I was so incredibly arrogant that I needed a couple of teachers to sort of rein me in and tell me what I could and couldn't do, which was helpful because now I know what I can and can't do. And it's... Well, it's helpful to have those rules, as Peter Carey said, in order to break them. So I'm actually a big fan of the MFA, mostly because I think Americans throughout their educations are taught to be incredibly arrogant, and it's good to have someone tell you, you know, have someone...
Wait, you really think that?
Oh, absolutely.
Every form of education, maybe some schools, but I mean, assumes...
Maybe I just went to the schools where they taught you to be incredibly arrogant.
Wow. I never took a sort of hubris 101, that's for sure.
I don't know. I don't think that we're instilled with a lot of humility, you know. And an MFA is good for that.
Now, there's been a lot of press of this basically commenting upon the bad tipping aspect of this. You know, doesn't this get in the way of actually the reception of people reading the book? Or is this not
Well, it remains to be seen. I can't complain about the press. You know, I mean, it's a pleasure that I get to talk about the book on Australian radio or... Radio Colombia, you know, because they're interested in the tipping. And most of the interviews I've done, they'll talk about the tipping a little bit, and then they talk about the book. And so it's almost embarrassing that that's what people have sort of picked up, these three sentences where I out the bad tippers of New York, celebrity bad tippers of New York. But I can't complain that it enlightens people to a book that I hope is... wise and funny and sad.
They keep referring to you more not as a author but as a barmaid.
I know. I've been referred to as a waitress and New York barmaid, and I don't even live in New York anymore. None of that bothers me. I'm thrilled. Anytime the book gets out there and people have an opportunity to pick it up and read it, I'm absolutely thrilled. Even if it has to be because they want to read about how Madonna doesn't tip.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like attention like this, as well as the whole Ben Kunkel situation that you were in, where basically there was a big war of words as to, like, you know, whether indecision could have been sort of the male version of Chick Lit if he had been actually, like, you know, a woman. I mean, don't things like this, I guess, detract from the text?
Absolutely. That's been a great fear of mine. And you know, the Ben Kunkel thing was just, I think the media sort of took that and ran with it. And I certainly am, you know, have no negative feelings even remotely towards Ben Kunkel, and I'm sure he doesn't have any towards me.
Yeah.
But if you were to read about it in the media, you know, it's, you know, I don't know. I guess it's fun. Conflict is fun. People want to read about it. You know, people, and they'll invent it if they have to.
Yeah.
But yes, it does. I have been concerned that it takes away from the text, and
well, it trivializes your book.
Absolutely.
As sort of, would you consider it chick lit or no?
What, my book?
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is a very loaded question. I don't want to...
Well, I'm just asking your opinion.
I don't know, because I haven't read any Chick Lit. But no, of course I wouldn't think that my book is Chick Lit, because I wrote a book that I would be obsessed with reading, and I'm not obsessed with reading Chick Lit. So I don't imagine that it is.
what models were there for this particular book?
I'm a big fan of Joan. I mean, all the obvious American influences, you know, big fan of Joan Didion and Ernest Hemingway. And there are a lot of allusions to Ernest Hemingway in the book. Some embarrassingly obvious allusions. But actually, to list your influences always sounds like such a pretentious exercise that I'm reluctant
to
do it.
I don't know about that. I mean, one can guess. I mean, I saw references to Revolutionary Road and, you know, things like that. But, I mean, it's also very helpful to sort of, I guess, see that this kind of came from a different sort of influence altogether, you know?
Yes. I don't know why, as a young woman writer, you can't just write about, you know, what's going on in your generation at the time without being, labeled. I don't want to be labeled.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm asking you about your influences, though.
Right.
You know?
Yes, you know, I read a lot of Chekhov, and I'm trying to get through all of the Proust right now, but I've got to say, anything past Swan's Way is kind of boring me. I'm trying the new translations. I'm a great fan of contemporary American poetry. I love Frederick Seidel and Carl Phillips and David St. John and Mark Strand and. So I guess this is where, and also I read the same things over and over and over and over. Frederick Seidel has a book called Going Fast that I am completely obsessed with. And while I was writing this book, I read that over and over and over. I read A Movable Feast over and over and over. And also I think it's probably no secret that one of the great influences is just that one essay, Goodbye to All That, that Joan Didion wrote when she left New York. And this book is sort of, it's what happens, you know, people pick up and leave New York behind at some point, usually.
Yeah. Was much of this book written in Los Angeles from, I guess, sort of outsider?
Except for the parts that were written, the short stories that were written here over the course of many years, and there are only a couple of them, most of it I wrote while living in Rome. So I was completely, I hope that it's a very American book because most of it was written while I was in the least American situation.
Did you find writing about locations in which you were not in to be a better sort of way to
easier.
Actually dwell upon them?
Much easier. Yeah, I find it much easier to write about New York when I'm in Los Angeles. And actually, having been in New York this week, I'm thinking of all of these Hollywood Hills stories. Now, I walk around the streets of New York, and it is so inspiring to be here. You know, I forget how exciting the energy is, and all I can think is, I'm going to write some more stories about dysfunctional people who live in the Hollywood Hills. So.
Do you find, also with, like, you know, reflecting upon past experiences and fictionalizing them, that having this kind of, I guess, distance is the only way that you can really sort of approach these things? Or?
Perhaps. A friend of mine said to me recently, we were talking about the book, and he really wanted to know specifically which points of dialogue had happened, which wasn't true.
Yeah.
And I was telling him quite honestly what I had overheard or what had actually happened to me in my own life and what hadn't. And he looked at me and said, Catherine, what's your inspiration when you're not writing for revenge?
Interesting. Well, was revenge due a factor in this? Obviously with the bad tipping.
I was going to say, speaking about the tipping, yeah, absolutely. I think that, people talk all the time about how you cannot write from revenge as any sort of inspiration. And William Gass, I think it was in his Paris Review interview, is the first person I had read of or heard of, or the first person to say, no, revenge is terrific inspiration. And thank God he's given me this liberation. He's given me permission to say, it is no longer against the rules to say that revenge is okay inspiration, which it is, you know.
Elmore Leonard, Get Shorty, there you go. So.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, revenge then, I suppose, is filtered through this kind of observational prism?
No, I don't think, there's not so much actual revenge in the book, you know. There's not any in the text, but when you're trying to sit down and do the work and focus and sit in your chair, I need some really, really compelling reason to get things done.
Yeah.
And money is a very compelling reason to get things done. So lately I'm not thinking in terms of revenge lately. I'm thinking in terms of I need to sit down and make some money and get my projects done.
Yeah, so really it's a very much, you're on Dostoevsky's sort of situation. I'm wondering why you decided to latch upon vignettes or anecdotal fiction as opposed to more of a sort of plotted kind of narrative. I mean, there's a plot to this, but this is very much a kind of string of stories. And also, kind of tangentially related to this question, to offer you a sort of larger answer, which I can ask another one. You know, why did you decide to start this story at, you know, the age of 7 or the age of 12? It's interesting. No one can actually determine exactly what the specific starting age of this book is.
Right. Wait, the first part of your question was?
It was related to vignettes and anecdotal
yes,
fiction
that's right.
versus
plotting. A plot is my weakness, you know. But this is what happens in life. You know, these little stories, these little things that happen to you do become a plot. And sometimes there are larger things. And within the book also, there are larger things that happen that can sort of constitute a plot on their own. But I haven't got round yet, maybe I will in my career, to thinking in, you know, very, very large plot terms.
Yeah.
I don't. I think in terms of dialogue and people and connections and conflict and what happens between individuals. And I didn't originally start the book when Catherine was so young. The book was sold about not even quite half done. And my incredibly brilliant editor, Courtney Hodell at FSG, is the one who wanted me to start it a little bit earlier. She wanted to see how this suburban girl gets somehow to this elite New England boarding school.
Yeah.
So I started it much younger.
Yeah. Would you categorize this as a sort of Bildungsroman to some degree? I mean, that's the feel I got from the 7 to the 30s.
Yes,
kind of
I mean, I guess, yes, if we have to label it, then yes, it absolutely is. I mean, that's pretty much the definition of Bildungsroman, right?
Yeah.
You know, a character.
It's like, it's almost textbook, you know,
yeah.
Penguin literary terms.
Yes. Oh, good. All right. That's excellent then.
I guess, do you think that sort of having a kind of larger sort of thematic sort of, this is the story of a young life and development kind of thing, that this is a better way to, I guess, facilitate kind of a loose collection of anecdotes for fiction? Or
I'm not sure. I don't know if it is a loose collection of anecdotes. I mean, I think the anecdotes, they're not just anecdotes.
Well, loosely plotted, I should say. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's plotted, but like I said, it's not, there's a narrative, but it's more a thematic narrative.
Starting when she's younger makes it a little more cohesive and maybe a little more accessible. You know, you don't have to launch right in the middle. I would have been perfectly happy to launch right in the middle. But you know, I'm not an editor, and now that, of course, the book is complete, it is such a better book, having started, you know, when you start at the beginning. It's really, it's a much more, I have, you know, obviously every writer has, five books in the desk, but this is the first manuscript I completed that is so much a sort of, you know, that follows so much the classic novel structure.
Yeah.
I'd never done that before. I like to be, this is, you know, it's the same thing about breaking the rules. I liked to write sort of, you know, novels where the plot didn't go anywhere. But this one moves in a very traditional way.
I wanted to actually ask you again about this irony of Ethan being this Diet Coke spokesman. it seemed, again, going back to this theme of New York about how people come here presumably to, you know, pursue their craft or whatnot and end up, you know, working for something like a shilling for the advertising agency.
Right.
First of all, I have to ask, do you have a brother named Ethan who is an actor? Or
no.
Okay. The second question I have to ask is again, these characters that popped up in the course of this writing, was it a matter of just really, again, irony? Was this the way to kind of, I guess, keep things flowing in terms of, like, you know, keep this this trajectory of catechism, so to speak?
I think the book is heavy on irony.
Yeah.
And even in the dialogue you quoted before, I mean, maybe that's what the short declarative sentences are about, too. There's a wry tone in the book, and yes, I absolutely love that Ethan, who is... Actually, I think Ethan is the book's great hero. He's really the least flawed character. And Ethan, this principled, down-to-earth, realistic, terrific kid with these great dreams, ends up as the face of Diet Coke, which, in fact, is a huge success for him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's the only one really seriously putting himself out there and trying to actually pursue some sort of career, too, and then it turns out to just be this kind of great...
The face of Diet Coke is, like, the hugest success in the book.
Yeah. Which is exactly what Stanislavski had in mind. You wrote on The Elegant Variation, where your guest blog, that you actually called information and asked for Dennis Johnson's number. What was all that all about?
I am a total stalker.
Really?
I loved Jesus' Son. And I was 19 years old, I think. 18, 19, something like that. And Actually, I was sick in bed, and I thought, ooh. And I didn't know, I didn't have any concept at that point of what a famous author was, or that anybody had ever even heard of Dennis. I didn't know how big the book was at the time. Everybody was reading it, but I didn't know that. So I thought, I'm going to call this man up and tell him how much I appreciated his work. And also, I thought that my opinion of his work, of course, must be very important, and must
going
be very important for him to hear as well. I think he probably couldn't have been more alarmed. I haven't done that since. I don't do that anymore, by the way. Now I wait for people to stalk me.
Gotcha. Well, Catherine, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks.
Thanks.
From the confines of New York, we move to the territory of summer camps. Although, if you're a parent listening to this program, by now the kids are probably coming back from those places just as you're trying to settle in to the dark days of summer with a tumbler of whiskey in your hand. Alas, the downside of human reproduction. God help the human race. Anyway, Mindy Schneider was herself one of those kids who went to those camps and wrote a book about it. But like me, she wasn't particularly happy about it, or so she says.
Okay, so I am here with Mindy Schneider, author of Not a Happy Camper. Mindy, how are you doing? I hope you're happier than your titles.
I think I am. Thanks a lot.
Well, first off, I actually wanted to ask you about the nature of this particular memoir. I mean, obviously, one's memory only goes so far, and I'm wondering what steps you took to sort of reimagine Camp Kinahura, because did you set any specific ground rules or anything as to what you could sort of, I guess, take liberties with, or... this didn't happen over one summer, did it, or...?
No, I went to this camp for several years, and I would always be telling friends in L.A., most of my friends are sitcom writers or performers, and they would always tell me, oh, you have to write that down, which I found very intimidating because I had absolutely no idea how. But in 1997, there was a reunion, a 75-year reunion for anyone who'd ever attended this camp.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I thought, well, I've got to start collecting the stories. And I bought a camcorder and I was very excited and thought, I'm just going to do this whole thing in a day, which, of course, was ridiculous. But it put me back in touch with people. And I didn't even start interviewing people right away because I still had no idea what kind of format. So I took some classes at UCLA Extension in personal essay and memoir and just fiction writing in general because all I knew was how to write sitcoms.
Yeah.
And then I got up a tremendous amount of nerve. I wrote down all of the anecdotes from camp that I could remember.
Oh, wow.
And I called up probably 10 or 15 people from camp, and I asked them the series of questions, and every single interview took exactly 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
So, which was kind of funny, and I have all of these on.
You had that many questions.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was like 10, 15 memorable incidents from the whole 5 or 6 years that I went there. And I wanted to fill in information, things I'd forgotten or things I'd never known. And then once I had that, I needed to figure out what to do with it. And a lot of people remember things I hadn't, but a lot of people's memories weren't any better than mine, which surprised me. Mm-hmm. And I finally decided I wanted to take the best of everything and set it all in my first summer, because I had a very clear idea of how I felt emotionally during my first summer, and no clear idea exactly of what happened, which summer. I mean, I sort of could remember. And I found out that you're allowed to do that, that you're allowed to compress things. I mean, some people suggested that I write a book that covers the entire 5, 6 years that I went to camp, but I thought, well, that's so boring. What do I have, these interim chapters? And then I went to school for a year and it was dull, and then I was back at camp. I couldn't do that.
So essentially, basically, this was your way of, I guess, getting to this sort of theme of looked on as this kind of, you know, sort of a misfit kind of character going to camp.
You know, that came about. I actually originally just wanted to write all the camp anecdotes.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that would have given me a book with absolutely no point of view.
Mm.
So I needed to have a main character, and it made sense that I would be it, even though that seemed really narcissistic because I'm no one. But then it became interesting to be writing a book from the point of view of no one in particular.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm wondering, this could have easily turned into sort of caricatures, a lot of the characters you have. For example, the extremely thin counselor that you introduced in
She was really thin. Yes. I had a couple of really thin counselors while I was there.
Well, I mean... What I mean to sort of suggest by this is that this could have easily devolved into sort of caricatures, and yet these characters are not quite like that. What steps did you sort of take to really allow these people in your life, so to speak, characters in the book, to sort of at least give them this extra-dimensional quality? So, because, I mean, it must have been hard because you're fixating so much on how absolutely super thin she is.
Well, I am fortunate in that I was able to remember a lot of people's quirks, mm-hmm. and then to try to help safeguard their privacy to some degree, I combined people. I mean, one year there was a girl in my bunk who walked and talked and did things in her sleep, and another one who read constantly and hated camp. So I compressed them.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be an interesting mix, and those two things were always going on in the bunk. And I found in early drafts, I'm not even sure if I did that in my first draft, but early drafts I had too many people.
Uh-huh.
So it was suggested to me by one of the teachers at UCLA, put them together, you're allowed to do that. And it made it much more manageable and easier to keep track of people. And I felt more comfortable because I wasn't giving away exactly someone's identity.
Yeah.
People I went to camp with definitely recognized some of the characters, but I don't think I did them in an unflattering way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed to work.
Well, here's the question. I mean, when you started off with this, you're pointing out that, you know, there's kind of logging your personal experience and your data. And when did you realize that you could actually take liberties along these lines, that you could actually merge people together and sort of get events in slightly out of sequence, but to fit the actual narrative? Did you learn this at your UCLA?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know what happened to it, but I could swear they told me there was a genre called creative nonfiction.
Yes.
Where you write exactly what happened, and when it doesn't fit together correctly, you fill it in. And I guess they don't stamp creative nonfiction on a book. It falls under the memoir category. But that's what I did. When things chronologically didn't make sense in a way that a reader would enjoy it, I shifted things around to link them up better.
Now, was it your idea to put a memoir on it, or was this Grove Atlantic's label that they put?
I can't remember.
Oh, really? Very, very nice.
I think it was...
You don't recall.
I think it was... No, I think when I turned it in, people said, is this a memoir? And I said, well, I mean, all this stuff really happened, and I put it all together, and I moved some things around and combined some people. And they said, yeah, that's a memoir. I said, okay.
Interesting. I mean, there's a controversy right now over whether there are too many memoirs and over whether certain kinds of books along these lines actually are memoirs. The difference by many highfalutin types is that, you know, okay, a memoir is essentially autobiography as through a sort of a thematic prism. Were you aware of any of these labels, and do you feel that your book sort of fits within this sort of thematic
brand? Yeah, I think my book does fit what you just said, and but really my goal was just...
How so?
Because I think it's from the point of view of a misfit 13-year-old, which I'm unfortunately able to channel really well to this day,
mm-hmm.
and I know that this is exactly how I felt in the summer of 1974, and these are things that went on at camp and people who were there. And I mean, in that way, I think this is a completely honest book.
Got you. What? Why did you settle upon 1974 as the year to, I guess, combine all these various summers?
This camp felt like it was so removed from the world, and I thought it was interesting to have it while Watergate was going on at the same time. And watching Nixon resign on TV was the only time I'd ever watched TV at camp, and so that is really memorable to me.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I mean, it just seemed so clear. It was like, well, of course it has to be about that summer.
Yeah.
And I was such a TV addict that it stayed with me because it was so amazing to me that I didn't care about TV at camp.
Well, you know, you specifically allude at a couple of points to your present sort of life by saying, I wrote satirical poetry. Wouldn't it be great to, you know, basically make a living from television? And it seemed to me when I was reading this, that you were almost kind of, I guess, oh, I want to tell the reader exactly what happened to me in the present. Were you an attempt trying to sort of, I guess, corral this impulse so that, you know, you wouldn't actually, like, you know, that you would focus specifically on this particular time period?
Oh, an earlier draft had more stuff about my family and about things in the present, and it was suggested to me, you know, cut it down and save it for something else and just stick to the stuff that really tells the story of camp and explains some of the backstory to that.
Yeah, gotcha. I mean, did you find the present as your kind of first point of reference to look to the past, or... How did you actually sort of make the past the kind of dominant sort of place where you were actually writing about?
I think that after a couple summers at this camp, I realized I loved it so much. I don't think a day of my life has gone by since the 1970s where at least once during the day I haven't thought of my camp. Mm-hmm. It was something that was always with me. And what's really nice now is I think now that the book is out, I'm finally done with it. Somebody at work was asking me if I was going to save all the clippings and put them together. Wouldn't that be really great to have? And I said, I just wrote a whole book about the camp. How much more stuff do I need? I think I'm done. Now I have to wait and see if other people like it.
Yeah. Well, was Kenny an amalgam of two people, or was he an actual singular person who you had a crush upon?
A couple of people, and the guy that I had, the first guy I ever kissed, won't recognize himself in the book because I'm sure he has absolutely no idea what was going on in my mind at that time. So I'm really happy it's safe there.
But most boys of that age don't really, you know.
Right. But even now, yeah. You know, he wouldn't, yeah.
Gotcha.
I'd be really pleased if certain people don't recognize themselves.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I mean, are there any of these characters based on one specific person, or are they all, I guess, out?
The camp owner is pretty close to the camp owner. The guy who was in charge of the Jim Norbert character,
yes,
and head of maintenance and canoe trips, was written as accurately as I possibly could, and other people I interviewed from camp filled me in on some information. Same thing with the chef. I talked to one of my friends who had worked in the kitchen one summer and filled in as much as possible.
The interesting thing about the whole kosher problem, mm-hmm, in this book is that you sort of, I guess, I wanted to actually ask you about this because you lead up to this whole dilemma of this camp supposedly being kosher and then actually, like, you know, mixing, you know, milk and meat and the like.
Right.
And what was interesting, though, is that you sort of repeatedly tell the reader, I am not supposed to combine milk and meat. I am not supposed to combine milk and meat. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how this came about. Did this come about from your editor at Grove Atlantic, or did this...
Oh, no. No. I mean, yeah. That's how my parents were. My parents were... My father was Orthodox. My mother grew up conservative but kosher. And even if none of our other friends were kosher, it was very important that we follow all of these rules.
Yeah.
And so I was very conflicted at camp because on the one hand, I knew that we weren't observing the rules, but I couldn't stand up and announce, you must, you know, yeah, use two sets of dishes and follow the rules only for me if nobody else cares. And I was hesitant to fill my parents in on what was happening, partly because once I realized I was having a good time, I didn't want them to tell me I couldn't go back there. But also, they spent a lot of money on this camp, so they would have been really upset to lose their money. So I was conflicted. Do I protect their money or do I protect the rules of kosher? So,
yeah,
you know, I was kind of stuck in the middle there, what to do about this.
Did you and your older brother ever determine how your father was able to actually pay for this remarkably expensive camp? Or?
Oh, yeah, he was a lawyer, but he was just, my parents were frugal. My mother still is. Only now it's a source of pride. If they would have filled us in,
yeah,
and told us,
yeah,
we're not as poor as we live, you know, there might have been less pressure. Or if we really were poor, stop sending us off to do things that kids with money do and then tell us you can't have a dollar to spend.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even throughout this book, and that's interesting because you don't actually mention that he is a lawyer in this book.
No, I think it is towards the beginning, because I have a
maybe,
part where...
Maybe I missed that. Because it's like, because you... Boy, I didn't even know this for some reason. Or I didn't even catch on to this because it's fascinating how you describe yourself. Oh, hey, I'm going to be getting a stereo. And then you have this other kid come and like, well, I have a stereo and I have hundreds of albums. Big deal. So, I mean, I guess this sort of...
Yeah, I didn't have a stereo till I was in college.
Yeah. Well, this sense of economics, it's interesting. And how did this kind of come about throughout, you know, sort of arranging all the various elements of the narrative?
I've talked to my older brother about this. We absolutely thought we were poor growing up. I mean, we went on these boring family vacations to colonial restorations, and it seemed like everybody else was going to all these cool places. We drove everywhere. We didn't take planes. It just seemed like everything we did, we wore hand-me-down clothes. It just seemed like everything we did was cut rate. The only thing we ever got new and nice were shoes. It was very important that when we outgrew our shoes, my mother would take us to get nice shoes. Mm-hmm. And we had shoe trees to preserve them. We polished our shoes. There was some sort of obsession with having good shoes. Everything else was, what's the cheapest we can possibly have?
Well, you describe this sort of closet of your father's, you know, in chronological order. Was this actually true?
Yes. My father had all of his clothes, and they were arranged chronologically. It started on the far right. There was the corduroy riding pants that he inherited from my Uncle Eddie, who's in his 90s now. And then then next to that was a World War II Navy pea coat. And I remember it moved through. There were these cuffed wool pants and white shirts from the 50s, which I think my father never stopped wearing. He did stop wearing the leisure suits from the 70s. And actually, when my father got all these really bright clothes, around 1970, my father had cataracts. And it was during the time when he was waiting to have surgery and was legally blind that a friend of his took him shopping. So he actually had no idea for several months that he was wearing mod clothing. And when he got his eyesight back and saw it was in the closet, he asked my mother whose clothes they were. And that was the way that we got him modernized.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Oh, I wanted to actually ask you about the photos in this book, many of them taken by you when you were, going to camp.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how, you know, if this is such a miserable experience, so to speak, why did you hang on to these photos for so long?
Because they cost money and we don't throw things away in my family.
Got you.
I mean, on the website, I included a picture of my parents on their honeymoon from 1957. My father had those same sneakers at least until 1982. And then he had heart surgery and had to work out more, and that was when he finally got new sneakers. And for years, I would ask him why he had these old sneakers, and he just kept saying, oh, they don't make them like this anymore.
Yeah. Likewise, all the sort of satirical tunes in this, were these actually taken from, you know, the camp experience, or did you make some of these up?
The photos in the book?
Well, no, the actual sort of tunes accompanying the photos.
Oh, no, those were all camp songs. And there were some... I had my brother Jay go online to the ASCAP and BMI website just to make sure everything was in public domain, but those were all things that we sang at camp.
In terms of, like, you know, research for the book, I mean, you know, you mentioned in the acknowledgments and you mentioned earlier in this conversation about talking to your friends about specific sort of experiences. What did you do to sort of, I guess, what did you do in terms of balancing your reliance upon memory for detail and your reliance upon friends? What was the kind of ratio, you know, between getting the accuracy of the camp?
I checked a lot of things on the internet. I checked with a couple of friends the route we took mountain climbing up Mount Katahdin, because I certainly didn't remember it, and I was stunned that some of my friends did remember it well. I bought a guidebook on eBay to research it.
Oh, wow.
And I found out, even after the book had sold and shortly before it went to press, my memory of how treacherous the knife edge on Katahdin was exaggerated. I thought I remembered it as being something like 8 inches wide and then a drop down, and fortunately I happened to email a couple of paragraphs to a friend who'd climbed it only a few years ago, and he emailed me back, the tricks your childhood memory plays on you. It was actually 3 feet wide. And I'm like, I'm so glad that I thought to check that with him, because I would hate to have inaccurately described geographical things.
Yeah.
So everything that crossed my mind to double check, I double checked. Every song reference in the book, I made sure that song existed at the time. Things like that.
Yeah. I'm wondering why you decided upon the camp experience as the sort of natural starting place to write a memoir, as opposed to, say, you know, later adolescence or early childhood. What was it about this kind of camp experience that said, oh, well, this is going to be perfect for creative nonfiction?
It just seemed, well, you know what? When I first started, I thought that I was writing about this camp because it was so unusual and so different. It was different and unstructured compared to the first camp I'd gone to. And I thought it was such a unique thing that I had to fill in the rest of the world on it. And it was only once I started writing it, and writing it from my 13-year-old point of view, that when I started showing samples of it to people, I found out it was more of a universal experience. And my first reaction to that was disappointment, because I thought I was writing something really unique. And it took me a while to realize, no, this is great. It's great that people can relate to it.
Yeah. Well, the whole Kenny figure, you know, one reads this, you know, now. I read this, and I'm like, oh, come on, you know, this guy's an obvious sort of creep. He's doing very bad things to you. What steps did you take to sort of, I guess, retain this kind of innocent quality of not being able to see the Kenny, you know, figures?
I seem to have naturally retained that, and the last couple of dates I went on, the guys were not kind, but I was finally smart enough not to take it personally.
Yeah. Gotcha. I mean,
I'm
but
like, oh yeah, okay, I get it.
But it's not just that; it's also the whole, you know, body image thing. You know, you write about your nose and not wearing.
Well, I left out in early drafts. I had anecdotes about how kids in school would walk up to me and just tell me how ugly I was. So that was something I carried around all the time. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I cut it from the book. But still, that was something that I felt for most of my childhood, and I think to some degree I still carry it. I'm still not thin, so I'll always feel like I don't quite look right.
Do you point out in the afterword that Camp Kinahura does not exist anymore?
Right.
Now, given that you uncovered valuations of campers, you know, while you were actually at camp, I was wondering if you ever sort of dug up similar valuations for those who went during the years of 1974 or the years that you actually
went to camp. No, I don't think they did. I mean, I remember those evaluations. They were in this closet under the steps in the boys' dining hall, and they seemed to be really critical of the campers. And I asked somebody, in the 70s about them, and they said, oh, they used to write up things about the campus to try and figure out who should be in what bunk the next year, which I find hard to believe because it was pretty much based on age.
Yeah.
I don't think that they wrote evaluations about us in the 70s. I think that was something that was abandoned, and I've actually never thought of it before, so if there are evaluations of me out there, I would be horrified if anyone unearthed them.
Were you aware of other camps that actually conducted similar evaluations along these lines when you talked to other friends about similar camps like this?
No. You know what? I've never heard of it anywhere. So maybe that was something they did in the 50s or something like that.
It's part of the whole, like, you know, I guess, Kinsley sort of, you know, inspiration.
Yeah,
you know?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you feel that, you know, somehow culture has lost something now that these 1970s summer camps are no longer around? Or are they actually sort of still around some places?
I don't know that a camp this loose is still around because it seems like every parent would sue over every incident. I mean, I wrote about one accident on a mountain climbing trip. There were others that happened that weren't as easily remedied, where kids were injured and didn't come back later in the summer. And I think insurance costs are probably a large part of the reason why camps are so much more expensive today. So I think because of that, camps are a little bit more structured. But also I think that a lot of camps today can only simulate the 1970s experience. We had no choice. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers. It was a big deal one year when a girl brought up a phonograph and two albums. I think she brought one Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, and it must have been in 76, and Frampton Comes Alive. And we were like, wow, we have two albums to listen to this summer.
Yeah.
Because apart from that, it was just transistor radios. And I think it's kind of a shame that that atmosphere doesn't naturally exist anymore. And I know from my reading and from my research, summer camps came about originally. Kids during the Civil War era were going out and emulating Civil War heroes.
Yeah.
So it was always supposed to be this natural nature experience. And now I think you really have to sort of concoct it.
Well, it's also not just the actual camp, but like, for example, the guy who you describe as the sort of mountain man who mm-hmm. grows his own food
yeah.
and who is very pro-nuclear power.
Right.
This is only a figure that you could find in such a camp like this. It's like the people who actually exist on the periphery.
And I didn't know all this stuff about him. It was when I was doing the research that I found out. I didn't know he lived in one of those trailers by the side of the road. I didn't know where he came from. I just knew he was there. I mean, if you had told me he was a million years old and had always been there, I would have believed it.
Yeah.
It was just, there were just certain people that showed up, and when I was 13, I didn't think to wonder about them.
So, I mean, did you take particular liberties in terms of, like, you know, having sort of run-ins with such figures along these lines? Or in terms of, like, for example, the mountain man growing his own food here?
Yeah, yes. In the book, I make it appear that I found it out then, but I don't remember what I knew about him then.
Huh.
So certain things, if I couldn't quite remember, like, I don't think I knew, I'm not sure if that I knew about the food coming from train wrecks then.
Yeah.
But I know that when I was doing the interviews for this book, two people mentioned it, and I was like, oh, yeah, okay. Or just one of the things that I'd totally forgotten about till a friend reminded me was that every time we walked to Boys Side around the lake, we had to pass by the house where the beekeeper lived and that there were swarms of bees. I totally forgot that until a friend reminded me, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. I remember we had to run through the bees every week.
Yeah.
And it was just funny to me, the most obvious things that I'd completely forgotten about, and then the minute details of certain things that absolutely stayed with me, and I don't know why.
There was an actual girl who, you know, basically fell off the mountain.
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Got it.
She fell off the mountain. She hit her head, she broke her ankle, she went home, she was bored, she came back, her counselors picked her up in the VW,
yeah.
They stole the wheelchair. I have other photographs that are much clearer, and you can see the Delta logo, but I felt it would have been too intrusive to put those in the book.
Yeah.
But, gotcha.
Now, the Philip character, which uh-huh. we haven't actually touched upon, I'm
okay.
curious, you know, how did these two archetypes, the Philip and the Kenny, come about? I mean, these, you know, obviously they're based off of multiple people, but I mean, were these the kind of two dominant sort of boyfriend potential types that you experienced going to summer camp over the years?
Yes. I mean, always for years. There'd always be some boy who really, really liked me, and it wasn't the one who I wanted to like me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, maybe I got over that by my 30s, so it didn't take too much for me to recall those feelings. And
yeah.
It's, you know, obviously if I had a time machine, I'd go back and, you know, date differently.
Now, in what sense did you, I guess, heighten this perspective of, like, you know, oh my God, you know, he thinks I'm terrible or something like that during the course of writing this?
I think I'm still like that, so I think it was just a constant. I don't think I heightened it. I think that's how I felt all the time.
Was any sort of part of your personality heightened during, you know, when we were actually contextualizing the narrative here?
I don't think so. I think I was just a person who always worried a lot, and I think the only difference now in my 40s is that I'm used to it. I'm like, yeah, that's how I am.
Now, in terms of, did you actually lower any particular sort of, I guess, things over the course of various drafts, in terms of perhaps certain feelings were honed over the course of writing and rewriting?
I don't know that there were really places where I lowered my emotions, because I think, well, at least well into my 20s, when I would be doing something and just having fun and not feeling pressured and just being content, it would actually flash through my mind, hey, you're just having fun right now.
Yeah.
And I think on a regular basis, the only time I've always been like that, and definitely still am, is when I play softball. Mm. I think.
So you still play softball?
I still play softball. I've always been good. Less so now, but considering I'm 46, I'm pretty good for a 46-year-old woman. I'm very welcome on the co-ed teams that I play on.
Yeah.
And I think the only difference is now I absolutely couldn't care less about winning. I have quit winning teams to play on teams that never win half the time. I absolutely play just because I enjoy the game, and I can't stand being competitive about it.
You're happy to be both the best and the worst athlete then?
Very much,
as opposed to just the best that you write your college applications. In this book, you consistently sort of compare the camp to another camp, Camp Cicada.
Cicada, right.
I intended to ask if there were other summer camps besides the one that was profiled in this book, but I mean, was there an actual sort of Camp Cicada-like qualifier?
Yeah, that is based on a camp that I attended for 2 years before going to the one in Maine.
Gotcha.
And it's pretty accurate. It's certainly how I felt about it, but I'm also aware of the fact that, I don't know if this comes across in the book, I know that a lot of people are really, really happy going to very structured camps like that with all these activities.
Yeah.
It just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And there are people who went to that camp who I've ran into in my 20s and in my 30s who I'm friends with now. But at that camp at that time, it wasn't a good place for me. And because I was from New Jersey and they were all New Yorkers, I was just instantly not going to be in the club.
Now, were there any particular, I guess, camp memoirs that you were aware of while you were writing this book, or any sort of books that you drew from to, you know, oh, that's it. I mean, I could see how this person is, I guess, recontextualizing things.
I think maybe Marjorie Morningstar. And I'm trying to think of other ones. I do reference Judy Blume's Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Yeah. But it sort of popped into my head when I got to that point. And I absolutely remember someone from camp who I think is now in the cast of Wicked on Broadway. I remember her reading aloud in one of the bunks from that book. And that was extremely entertaining.
Wow. Wow. Gotcha. Now, there are various nicknames that you rely upon. The
right.
Icky Orgy, the Hanky Panky Suite, the Green Truck, all these.
We called the Green Truck the Green Truck.
Yeah.
And the one that I refer to as the Food and Garbage Truck, we called it the Blue Truck, and it was when I was talking to one of my friends from camp, and we were talking about the truck that brought the food around in the morning, and then elsewhere in the conversation we were talking about the garbage truck, and that's when the two of us realized, oh my God, it's the same truck. It was the food and garbage truck.
Wow.
And so for the sake of keeping it clear in the book, instead of having the green truck and the blue truck, I just called it that.
Oh, gotcha.
Rummel's Ice Cream in Waterville, Maine really did have a make-your-own sundae called an Icky Orgy. And people who remember it have been emailing me through the website.
Really? There really was an Icky Orgy?
Yes, and that there's a photograph in the book of the pin.
Oh, wow.
I still have the pin. And apparently it's highly collectible, because eventually Rummel switched over to just giving out stickers. I wore that to the reunion in 97, and there was somebody who was really jealous that I had the button with the stick pin in the back.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you know, was this kind of nostalgia, which is throughout the book, I mean, you do a very good job, I think, of really kind of not making the book about nostalgia, but about your personal experience. Was getting, you know, cultural sort of minutia like the Icky Orgy, was it something of a kind of effort, struggle for you to kind of, I guess, keep that contained, or would, you know, maybe you can talk about the relationship with nostalgia?
I think so, because VH1 has all those nostalgia shows, and if you want to be bombarded with nothing but, I mean, I enjoy those shows, but if you want to be bombarded with nothing but nostalgia, you can look at something like that. So I tried to use it just where it pertained to what I was writing. I didn't want to make it a list of look what I remember.
Yeah.
But I still wanted to make sure that the reader always knew they were in the 70s.
Did you ever get to visit south of the border?
No, I have never been to south of the border.
I didn't get a chance to Google this.
We have only driven past it.
Wow. I didn't get a chance to confirm its veracity. I didn't even know if it actually existed.
I think it still exists.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have the hundreds of miles of billboards as you head. But we, could, I guess, just so people know, we drove in the summer, not in the summer, in the winter. It might have been December of 73 or January of 74. I can't remember which. But we drove from New Jersey to Orlando. My father had a convention there, so we took time off from school and we went to Disney World. And as you start getting within a few hundred miles of Dillon, South Carolina, you start seeing billboards for this place called South of the Border, like it's the greatest place in the world. And it really isn't, but I guess. I don't know because I've never been there. But for people who are bored to death driving in their car for days, that's probably a really good place to stop. And I'm sure my family is the only family that didn't stop.
Yeah, wow.
And that's what's memorable. If we had stopped there, I probably wouldn't even remember the place. But because we drove past it, I will always remember it.
But there are many sort of places like that along the highway where if you had actually gone to it, it would probably lose its kind of mystical appeal. You know what I mean? No, that's interesting.
It has been suggested to me, though, that I should finally go and visit it. But
then it would might lose its charm.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mindy, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks.
Looking out my door, my little bit of country love.